Obama leading in polls. Wall Street Journal sued for publishing Kate Middleton topless pics. Ashton Kutcher.
Whoa, sorry about that. A little mix up with the clip there from our Celebrity Exploit Morning Sister Show.
When all you have is a search engine, everything looks like a database.
Let's move on.
Privacy is nothing to be granted. Privacy is something you take yourself.
They've got the Mossad, the CIA, and Hillary Clinton behind them. We're now beyond what Stasi could even dream of.
Reality Exploit Roundtable.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Reality Exploit Roundtable, Episode 9. Today, I am your moderator, Hero, and we have Voodoo with us. Welcome back to the show, Voodoo.
Thank you, sir.
And Smuggler.
What's up?
Plato.
Hey, Hero.
All right, and Wise Guy is back with us today.
Yo.
Well, let's head on here. We have several interesting topics today. First one we'll kick off with is JavaScript crypto in the browser.
Real crypto in the browser? /. The W3C Web Crypto API first public working draft has been published. Web Crypto API, the abstract. This specification describes a JavaScript API for performing basic cryptographic operations in web applications, actually inside the browser, such as hashing, signature generation and verification, encryption and decryption. Additionally, it describes an API for applications to generate and or manage the key material necessary to perform these operations. Key storage is provided for both temporary and permanent keys. Access to key material is contingent on the same origin policy. Uses for this API range from user to service authentication, document or code signing, and the confidentiality and integrity of communication.
Plato, let's assume this gets implemented as secure as it can be for the browser and it gets implemented well. It seems like having a PGP capabilities and a full crypto stack for the user to communicate with the web applications or user to communicate with other users through Dropboxes or message queues of web applications, say mixed with streaming apps and WebSockets, P2P encrypted file transfer in the browser, all this stuff. Is this revolutionary or no?
It sounds revolutionary to me, especially if we can get all the stuff implemented that you're talking about. Crypto is super powerful, and right now it's super hard to use. Look at Bitcoin OTC. What that enables is a web of trust where you can have thousands of users who are trading with each other, and they can have some assurance that they're actually trading with the same person who has a trade history, because the Gribble bot on the Bitcoin OTC channel on Freenode, that bot is requesting proof of identity from every user by using a PGP key. And that system's hard to use. It takes a while to set up a key and use a command line and get it registered on the channel. And you know, it's too difficult for my grandma to use. But if all she has to do is click a little button in Firefox that says generate an identity and then click another button that says like sign a document, that's a whole lot easier, and it could bring crypto to the masses. And I can only start to think of the applications that you could build once you have in browser crypto, and the first one I want to see is a web of trust. I want to see signed forum posts so I can prove that this message from me on Reddit is the same person as this message on the Bitcoin OTC forums, and it's not just some other guy who took the handle Plato.
Yeah, that's great. Bringing up the Gribble bot for the Bitcoin web of trust system is a perfect example. And man, that thing is hard to use. And the instructions and how you have to go through it. And sure, it's just using your basic PGP a key that you generate for it, and you just sign a message. But the whole the way that you have to upload your key to a key server and then register it with the Gribble bot, and then it sends you something, then you have to go off with that. And then when you log in another time and your host mask has changed on IRC, it is just it works out great. I mean, for what it does, it's great. but it's definitely not something like you were bringing up where this could actually be done in the browser. This, and you brought up a post being signed. This could be something where this whole problem with authenticating who you are through these OAuth and browser personas and these all secondary and third party identification services could be implemented in here. And I think that the great stuff, like you said, is that we cannot even hardly imagine right now some of the stuff that can be done way beyond what some of these guys are even thinking of right now. Smuggler, I want to hit you on this. From a technical standpoint, is this going to be possible for these guys to do this correctly, or is this a good start that other people with more solid crypto knowledge can actually latch onto?
Well, it's surely a good idea to start working on the whole thing. I mean, I've been a proponent of in-browser crypto APIs for years now. I mean, if you know me for a while, you will have seen the one or the other rant saying that the browser goes nowhere without crypto APIs. So it's a really good move here. If it can be implemented correctly and then used correctly by others, it's a whole different issue. There are quite some security issues that have to be solved in the context of the browser. And currently they say they will implement this with a key store that is based on the same origin policy, which means that only website A can read the key store that was generated from a script by website A. Website B can only read the keys from website B, and so on and so on. So that makes some cases much harder, and it really only means that there are additional ways to communicate safely between the server and the browser. If it extends to much more than that, much more than an SSL replacement, remains to be seen.
Right. One way I can see getting around that is with browser extensions. So you could have a Firefox extension which has access to the full API and can do anything cross domain and maintain its own key pair set that can be used for identification on 1,000 websites. And so there's a lot of stuff that can be done outside of, I don't find what's going to be able to be done necessarily with the servers necessarily that interesting as what can be done from the users, the way that the user projects themselves to the world is more interesting than them saying that a particular website can request certain keys and specify what needs to be done on your side, because that it starts to get into more of a centralized system where they're requesting particular. For one example, with an extension that has full access, you would be able to choose the identity that you are presenting to every website that you're accessing, rather than them actually requesting stuff and having access to your keyring. I remember that the Fire GPG extension for Firefox, which people should check out for an early attempt at something like this, that was an extension. They had some server stuff in there also, where the servers themselves would be able to request certain type of operations in your browser, and it was always kind of a hokey thing.
Well, it's important to note here that an extension is not really the same thing for the market to accept this than something that comes with the browser by default. We have had extensions to do crypto in the browser for some years now, and they get nowhere. And my hope is that sooner or later, the browser manufacturers really have a standardized API for crypto that also comes with the necessary user interface changes and necessary design choices to make it a secure thing and a cross-site thing. And that is my hope, and I hope that the Web Crypto API is the first step into that direction, and that, you know, with a little bit more lobbying and more development, maybe sooner or later, crypto can actually be in the hands of the masses.
Yeah. Can we take this down a notch for dummies like me? You know, anybody listening who maybe thinking, okay, what does it all this have to do with the price of bread? When you go to your bank's website and you're doing transactions with your bank, that's a secured connection between your browser and the bank's server, web server, ostensibly. It's supposed to be secure. But when you are emailing back and forth to your banker or back and forth to your broker, most likely, unless you've installed the ability to encrypt emails, you're sending those emails back and forth in plain text. And so, you know, anyone who's in the middle can read all the traffic you have going back and forth to your banker and your broker. But what this will do is make as a standard part of your browser. So you don't even have to think about the cryptography. It'll just be baked into your browser and you'll be able to use public key cryptography all day long and not have to think about it, not have to deal with keys. It'll all be running in the background and make sure that all your communications are secure, not just the ones with the little padlock on it.
So what does this do to governments that are doing man-in-the-middle attacks by their privileged access to the domain name system?
Well, one of the things that you have to keep in mind with the current specification, and it's really not implemented, you know, that it's just a working group and they have some drafts out there. But there are, I think, two demo implementations for Chrome and for Firefox. But the real thing to keep in mind is that there's a binding between the server and the browser right now, same origin policy. So it's just an extension, so to speak, of the security of the server to the browser. And this also means that attacks like code poisoning that we have seen in cases like Hashman or something like that are totally possible. So the government just has to go to the server operator and say, poison the JavaScript and send us the keys. So that is one of the big issues right now.
But how about the URL, the domain name poisoning that goes on with privileged access to the domain name system where you can do man-in-the-middle attacks?
That would work like before. You could actually, if it's not SSL protected and all that, the government could do a man-in-the-middle and send new JavaScript that reads the keys and sends them back.
So the idea here with this code poisoning is that you go to CryptoCat.com or whatever, and that web server responds with a web page, and that web page contains a JavaScript web app, and that web app purports to do cryptography and encrypt all your communications, but there's a chance that the server on the other end, owned by CryptoCat, either they're malicious or they got hacked, and they're actually serving you some fake code that is not secure, and maybe it's sending it to a third party, or maybe it's just bad crypto. So, Smuggler, you were mentioning something about frozen JavaScript, and I mentioned something. If I start playing with this, I'm going to be doing just total local web apps that you install as a Chrome app, and it's never communicating with any server. It's just entirely on my machine, and that way I know that the code that I wrote is the code that's on the computer. But what's this frozen JavaScript about?
Well, frozen code essentially means that the API takes a hash of the code that has generated the keys or accessed the keys last. And as soon as the code changes, the application, the browser talks to the user and says, hey, the application has changed. Do you want to give it access to the keys? So essentially, it detects if code has changed and if a code poisoning is going on. So that is what frozen code is about.
That's great. That's one of the things that I was going to bring up about the CryptoCat stuff is that if the API properly implemented in this should support something like that, where you have pre-known code that has a hash fingerprints or whatever on it, so that you know when you're executing it that you're executing the same exact code for checking either a crypto, like you're talking about with keys, that's awesome for local stuff, but even for remote stuff, so that you could run JavaScript applications hosted in the cloud that have been checked not to, of course, to have their own internal evaluation where they execute external code, but specific JavaScript applications that are self-contained that you can run from anywhere and trust them loading. Like right now, for example, the Google Analytics is running on half the Bitcoin websites out there that require logins, which means that, and they're pulling the Google Analytics JavaScript code off of the Google servers, which means Google could replace that JavaScript code with malicious stuff that sends out or grabs all your Bitcoins and sends them out to someone else from these web applications, even some trading platforms and stuff do this. So in this with the proper setup here, you would be able to run Google Analytics code that was preset with a particular hash that was hosted anywhere in the world, and you wouldn't have to worry about them someone poisoning it, because you would be running a hash check on it when it ran inside your system. This is part of the Skyhook stuff with Namecoin and everything. You could use Namecoin system to pre-publish these hash codes of these programs. So I don't know, I see a lot of good stuff possibly coming from this, but it is scary. Thanks you guys for bringing up some good points and concerns about where this is going, but it's a good start. Let's move on to the next topic.
Argentina bans PayPal. The BBC reports, the online payment service said that from 9th October, Argentina resident PayPal users may only send and receive international payments. Last year, the Argentine government announced restrictions on the purchase of US dollars. It has led to an increase in currency sales on the black market, but PayPal's exchange rates are better. Locals were setting up two accounts under different email addresses and transferring money between the two, exchanging local currency pesos for dollars in the process. Under the new rules, only one account per person can be registered within Argentina. When the news was announced, Finance Minister Amado Boudou, who has since become vice president, told the BBC it was an important measure to combat tax evasion and money laundering. Since the rules were introduced in November 2011, PayPal has been used as an alternative means of obtaining the U.S. currency close to the official exchange rate, which currently stands at about 4.7 pesos per dollar. That is much cheaper than the rate on the black market, where $1 costs about 6.3 pesos. Also, in September, the government established a new 15% tax on all purchases made abroad, affecting credit cards and purchases made on international websites like Amazon and eBay, and transactions made on PayPal.
Budu, I thought it was interesting that the black market has more expensive rates than the official banks. In many countries, it's the black market that has better rates than the official banks, driving people to use the cheaper market. This is not the case in Argentina, which leads me to think that using PayPal for black market exchanges was truly driven by what the government claimed as tax evasion. Why use PayPal when government banks have even better rates, unless you have something to hide since you're working in System D?
Sure, the government banks have better rates, but you can't buy the dollars there. They could make the dollars free if they're not going to give them to you when you hand them cash for them. This is just a case where PayPal could actually buy dollars at close to the official rate, and no one else could. Argentina is... You would charitably describe Argentina's financial situation as a basket case. They've just inflated their currency so badly that nothing works really well. There was about a year ago, year or two ago, they were running out of coins in Argentina because it cost too much to mint the coins. They had debased their currency so badly that it didn't matter what the value of the coins was. They couldn't afford to actually mint the coins, so the merchants didn't have any coins. So what would happen was there was expediters that would go to the bus depots, and they'd wait for the buses to come in and then buy the coins off the bus drivers, then take them to merchants and sell them to the merchants at a premium. The merchants would go to the bank and they would try and buy coins, and they were limited to, I believe it was like $20 worth of coins a day, which, you know, was one roll of quarters, and that just wasn't cutting it. Argentina has been working this currency manipulation for a long time. It's not surprising to me at all that people were finding that better rates and working the system to find a better rate through PayPal. We see it over and over. In Harare, Zimbabwe, there wasn't enough U.S. dollars downtown. They were awash in Zimbabwe dollars, but they didn't have any U.S. dollars, which was really the only currency people would take. So they would take huge stacks and bundles and wheelbarrows full of Zimbabwe dollars, and people would take them out to the suburbs where they could buy dollars, and then bring those U.S. dollars. They would bring those U.S. dollars back downtown Harare for use in commerce down there. That's what happens. The intelligentsia wants us to think that the hoi polloi doesn't have a clue about currency manipulation, but I've seen it firsthand that the hoi polloi is actually very, very good at finding those eights and quarters and finding where they can make a little bit off of each transaction.
You know, I remember a story about Zimbabwe that the workers were demanding to be paid twice a day. They wanted to be paid at noon and at the end of the day so that they could cash out. The inflation was happening so fast that they wanted to exchange their Zimbabwe dollars at noon before they devalued so much by the end of the day.
This is exactly what happened in the Weimar Republic in Germany.
Yeah, and it was the same deal. I believe the official exchange rate for Zimbabwe dollars to U.S. dollars was 1,500 to 1, but the actual rate, the black market rate, where you could actually buy U.S. dollars as opposed to the official rate, you couldn't buy any U.S. dollars at that rate, but the actual rate was closer to 800,000 to 1.
You know, back to the little thing that these guys were doing down here, so they set up a PayPal account. And they set up two PayPal accounts, and they were sending money back and forth between Argentina pesos and dollars in order to balance out their transactions on the street. I think it's fascinating here that of all systems, these people were actually gaming their own government with PayPal, and a lot of people are trying to avoid the problems with PayPal. Especially in European countries, PayPal users are getting completely screwed with the exchange rates and the cost per transaction. The percentage per transaction is so much higher than it is in the U.S. So it'd be interesting to see what's going to happen when some of these people, they may not be playing the system with Bitcoin, but when they're looking for a dollar-denominated system to go with something like the MT Gox right now has dollar-denominated accounts, and there are some digital currencies that are coming out right now, like VoucherSafe, which has some dollar, and there's some Loom currencies out there. As these things start getting a lot more popular, we might see that these people actually really using them down on the street, just like they're using PayPal, in an explosive way. Smuggler, do you have something? Go ahead.
I would suggest what you'll see on those exchanges will be closer to the black market rate. PayPal was able to offer the lower rate because they could actually go to the bank in Argentina, the government bank in Argentina, and buy U.S. dollars with the Argentine pesos at the official rate.
What's to prevent someone from setting up sort of an organization in the U.S. to help the Argentine people out and start selling PayPal accounts?
Well, for one, if that happens on a large scale, the Argentine government would probably just stop doing business with PayPal.
And the U.S. government would probably get after you for money laundering.
I doubt that's going to happen on any small scale.
Yeah, that was one little hack I saw in the system. Is the new rules say only one account per person can be registered in Argentina, and you can't do payments within the country. And it seems like, and I'm sure that they're already doing that, if any of these people who were doing the system and who were gaming the system in this small way were doing it inside the system, it would be all they need to do is find someone that is outside of the country. But also I saw they have that 15% tax that they were talking about on purchases made abroad, including transactions made on PayPal. So it sounds like if anybody tried to game this system using an international transaction with a friend or somebody who offered the service, they would be hit with a 15% tax on every transaction. So you know, but that's just as well because, you know, these guys, let them go ahead and do their system and let this pressure come down on alternative systems coming out there for these people to be able to use. So, Smuggler, did you have something to add onto this?
Nope.
Great. Move on to the next topic here.
Fool's Gold discovered in New York. Tyler Durden on Zero Hedge reported yesterday. My Fox New York reported that a 10-ounce gold bar costing nearly $18,000 turned out to be a counterfeit. The discovery was made by the dealer Ibrahim Fadl, who bought the PAMP bar in question from a merchant who has sold him real gold before. But he heard counterfeit gold bars were going around, so he drilled into several of his gold bars worth $100,000 and saw gray tungsten, not gold. The bar was filled with tungsten, which weighs nearly the same as gold but costs just over a dollar an ounce.
We have links in the show notes. I suggest everybody take a look at this. It's quite fascinating to see the little drill hole and how they had this thing covered and looked like gold foil. And it looked like someone who had opened up like a chocolate bar or something like that, peeled off with the foil on the outside. Wise guy, we have seen this recurring every few years now, fake silver and gold bars. Is this truly a global scam by some big-time players? Or is this some discovery of a few small scammers who are just gaming a couple of bars? Or is this a scam of a scam, as Durden suggested, a possible false flag to try and scare everyone out of metals and into real, cold, hard cash money like the U.S. dollar?
Well, I think what's happened here, if you believe many of the reports that have been circulating now for years, since perhaps the 90s and even into the early 2000s, is that because of the efforts of central banks to manipulate and regulate the gold market pricing, they may have actually stepped way over the line and decided to get into the business of fraudulently creating gold. There were reports that in the 1990s, under the Clinton administration, huge numbers of tungsten ingots that were curiously about the size of 400-ounce bars had been manufactured and shipped around. Some of those reports indicated that it might have been the delivery might have actually been taken by the U.S. Mint itself and put into Fort Knox. It's really hard to tell. However, there were reports from China, which is the largest foreign holder of U.S. treasuries, that they detected huge numbers of tungsten, gold bars, that were actually tungsten bars coated with gold. And I believe that the number of bars represented about $600 billion. However, I don't believe that there was any public comments after these accusations, and who knows what happened to them. I would not be surprised if they were true. However, the bars that were recently discovered are probably the result of criminal enterprise taking a cue from government or the reported government funds. So I think that, yes, it may be destabilizing to people's expectations that their gold holdings, either some of these papers or paper gold holdings or EFTs, might actually be holding nothing more than gold-plated tungsten bars. This could be an economic calamity of immense proportions if it turns out to be true.
Yeah, that's a good point. With the like the Kitco price on gold, a lot of that has to be influenced by these big gold holders like Goldman Sachs and all these governments who are holding gold. But how much of that is physical and how much of it is certificates? Because if you inflated the gold supply by filling these tungsten bars and not really having that much gold, then the gold certificates are going to be overpriced.
Well, it really depends on what kind of gold the certificates are made up on. Not all gold is equal. You have processes, markets that have validation in process. In, for example, the LBMA system, which actually relies on melting down gold very frequently, which makes it pretty expensive, but also makes sure that the gold handled there is actually gold and nothing else. So you have a very frequent meltdown as soon as something leaves the system as a system or get recertified. And I actually do have to disagree with WiseGuy on the source of the problem. For years now, at least 20 years now, you were able to buy fake gold coins and fake gold bars from companies that produced them for display purposes or demonstration purposes or something like that. I mean, right now, one of the biggest sellers for fake tungsten gold bars sits in China, I guess. China tungsten, if I remember correctly. And you essentially can go there and order a gold coin or a gold bar that is really just gold-coated tungsten. And that has been going on for a long time now, because merchants don't want to put their really expensive gold bars into their shopping windows, so they put tungsten bars in there. And what happens frequently, so it seems, is that, you know, fraudsters and scamsters go out and take the same bars, so to speak, and try to present them as real.
Wow, so you're talking the manufacturing and selling these things in China as a complete brick and mortar above board business, not even something like these pirate manufacturers.
Yes, especially when it comes to bars, because bars are no legal tender. So creating a tungsten bar that is gold covered and comes with some stamps is not even a crime. If you do that to a gold coin, depending on what coin that is, that would be a serious crime. It would be presenting, you know, a fake legal tender thing, like when you do that with Krugerrands or something like that. That's actually a crime. But for bars, that's not a crime. And there's always a demand for those fake display bars from banks and stuff like that. I mean, if you go into a bigger bank or something that is in the gold business, they will display you several kinds of gold products. But most of the time, those gold products that are displayed in the public places are not real. I mean, you don't put a 20,000 or more US dollar bar out in the public. So those are actually tungsten bars that then can be handed over to the client if he wants to feel gold, so to speak, but it's not really gold.
Fascinating. One thing back to the discovery of these bars is that it's not in the best interest of most parties to actually discover or release information about these things. Most people who hold these things, if they do have something that's fake, they don't even want to know about it. They want to pass it on. Now, I say this from experience also in some other countries that I've been in where fake bills are going around. And a lot of times you'll have someone try to pass you off a bill and they know it's fake, but they're not a counterfeiter, but they got stifled or whatever. They got scammed with that by somebody else, and they want to pass it on to the next person. So one technique, sometimes if you have that happen and you need to like find out whether it's a false or not, the best thing to do is you have to go to the bank with the person who gave you that note before you actually take it to yourself. Because once you've accepted it for some type of a goods, you've taken on responsibility. If you go to a bank and you have them check it, if they see the moment that they see when they run it through their machine or whatever they do, when they see that it's a fake one, they take these paper hole punchers and punch like a massive number of holes inside of it and then stamp it with something showing that it's a fake. So, I mean, the money, you ask them to check it, and then if it's false, they destroy it in front of you. So anyone who has one of these gold bars, or this is happening with silver also, they're going to want to pass it on. So it's really the discovery point is going to have to happen, whether like somebody's going to have to get it and they're going to have to drill it down, or and then take the, if they do that, like I said, why is it in their interest to drill this down? It's been their best interest to not even know and then pass it on to somebody else, or when it gets to the point of being melted down. So I don't know how anytime soon that a lot of this stuff is going to be discovered as being fraudulent. without everyone just going to melt down their stuff. And most people aren't going to just want people to come in and melt their stuff down. Although when they sell it, buyers may be a little bit more strict and concerned and paranoid, and they'll want to have it melted or drilled before they pay.
Well, I actually think that people should be more wary about that whole issue because it's so easy to get fake. And there are pretty good ways to protect yourself against this. And especially in the coin business, where that happens quite a lot, there are special scales for gold coins that can be used to check that it's exactly the right volume and exactly the right density and so on and so on. And those are not too cheap. I mean, it's a few hundred bucks, so it's more for professional dealers. But there are things like gold scale and the fish and stuff like that. And if you're into collecting coins, or if you want to save for hard times in gold coins, you should really, really get something like that. And make sure that you're not the receiving end of a scam.
Well, two more things here. One is that in 2004, there was an investigation that was launched, I believe, apparently by the district attorney in New York and in the Manhattan district. This is during the time that perhaps the Clinton gold heist was actually being looked at by U.S. officials. And according to a report in a major news magazine, I think it was, I'm trying to remember who it was, can't seem to find the link for that, but the reporter Jenna Anderson reported that a top executive at the New York Mercantile Exchange was being investigated by the Manhattan District Attorney. Now, all of that person's records were taken out during that investigation. And the guy that was being investigated, a guy named Stuart Smith, he disappeared shortly afterward. No charges were ever brought. But the kinds of records that were removed and the part of the operation in NYMEX that he was part of would be the exact part that would have the serial numbers, the smelter origins of every gold bar ever physically settled on that exchange. So one has to wonder whether something was actually going on, and either the local district attorney took it on his own to start investigating, and maybe it was quashed by higher level people. Who knows? That's certainly one item. I can't remember the other one at the moment. I'll just hold on for a minute.
What's interesting is the entire system of volume and weight and the stamps and the serial numbers and the serrated edges on rounds and all this stuff is exactly based on this attack. This is the attack that all of that is supposed to and assaying. You take a section of a shipment of gold and you assay it to make sure something like this isn't happening. But this is the attack that the entire system is. Built to defend against, and yet it's treated as some sort of a conspiracy thing whenever this shows up. Oh, no, this isn't really happening. These are just some gold cranks that are saying this. This is, you know, it's kind of like having a cash register and then being called a crank when you get held up at a 7-Eleven.
You know, one thing that strikes me is that the whole industry uses these serial numbers and these stamps and these identifying markings to keep track of the products and make sure that what you're holding is real gold. But it honestly can't be that hard to counterfeit that in the age of 3D printers. Shouldn't you be able to, you know, print out a copy, file it down a little bit to make it all smooth, make a mold, and cast your fake?
No, actually, when you're talking about professional dealers in the gold market, especially for the banks and allocated storage and whatever, most of them are taking part in certified gold circuits, which means that they are actually melting down the gold over and over and over again. But you don't do that for a gold coin. You do that for real gold, like for a kilogram or something. You're not doing that for a few grams or a few ounces. So it's really an attack that hits people that are dealing with low amounts or that are taking shortcuts in the whole process of gold dealing. It's hitting the unprofessionals and the small-time people first. And I personally think that while I believe some of those conspiracy theories might actually be true when it comes to the manipulation of the gold price, I don't think it's done by flooding with gold, because flooding the market with gold, especially in the central banks, could very, very well offset some of the accounting measures that the governments themselves profit from. So I'm not a big fan of that theory.
And I don't think they're flooding with fake gold either. If they're flooding with anything, they're flooding with paper receipts.
Exactly.
That are, you know, that don't have any, there's nothing in the safe to back up that paper receipt.
Yeah, there's some scams out there going on with where one company will be holding, will own the gold, and then they'll lease that gold out to someone else. And then the person who's leasing it puts it on their books, and then they leverage that, and then someone else leverage, and then it goes round and round, and then it turns into almost this circular derivative thing where there's actually, because there's certain things you can do in the book to show that the gold is yours. And actually, if you trace it all back, you find out that the physical gold itself is on the books of several companies. So there's a lot of things you can do on paper to duplicate some of this stuff. Real quick, for on a technical note, I saw a lot of people were wondering, well, you know, how can you just like coat something up and get so close? On the article that we mentioned, the Zero Hedge article, there was a commenter here, and I haven't checked this out, but this is what they're saying. Gold's density is 19.30 grams per cubic centimeter. Tungsten's density is about 19.25 grams per cubic centimeter. Only 0.26% different. So 10 troy ounces of gold occupies a volume of 16.116 centimeters cube. And 16.116 centimeters cube of tungsten weighs 310.236 grams, or 9.974 troy ounces. The difference between those two is only 0.0259 troy ounces. That's why it's so difficult in these things to just detect them by, you know, holding in your hand or just looking at a simple scale.
Well, actually, with a good scale, that is trivial to measure.
Well, the problem, though, is you're not measuring necessarily the weight. I mean, you may be able to see a weight difference. It's the volume. So when you measure a particular bar, you have to know, okay, this bar was manufactured with this serial number from this particular company. So its exact weight and volume should be this, and then that's what you have to go on.
Right, but it's really, really trivial to measure density if you're a professional dealer. There are off-the-shelf tools for you that do that. You put them in there, they measure the volume, and they measure the weight, and they actually measure some electric and magnetic properties as well. So it is something for a professional very hard to do. Very easy to do, to verify. It's something that is for the amateurs that really takes it down.
Great info. Anybody else have anything to add on this before we move on? Okay, let's move on to the next topic.
Your keys or your life. John Matonis on Forbes wrote, "Jail time for refusing to comply with mandatory key disclosure hasn't occurred in the United States yet, but it's already happening in jurisdictions such as the UK, where a 33-year-old man was incarcerated for refusing to turn over his decryption keys, and the youth was jailed for not disclosing a 50-character encryption password to authorities. Similarly harsh key disclosure laws also exist in Australia and South Africa, which compel individuals to surrender cryptographic keys to law enforcement without regard for the usual common law protection against self-incrimination. Key disclosure laws may become most important government tool in asset seizures at the war on money laundering. When charged with a criminal offense, that refers to the ability of the government to demand that you surrender your private encryption keys that decrypt your data. If your data is currency such as access control to various amounts of Bitcoin on the blockchain, then you have surrendered your financial transaction history and potentially the value itself."
Smuggler, it does seem that these laws could easily apply to any standard Bitcoin client which supported its own encryption systems for encrypting keys, which is not default in the the Bitcoin protocol itself. It's something that's implemented in the wallets. They see a wallet, they confiscate your equipment, you're at a border crossing, they see a Bitcoin wallet, and they want the keys to decrypt it. But things get a little hairy when your wallet is an Electrum client or with a Brain wallet that has deterministic keys, so there's no actual keys that are located on the machine. There is nothing showing that you have keys. Electrum and Brain wallet type systems seem like a bona fide method of plausible deniability. For the Electrum client, you can always give them the passwords that reveal an alternate clean wallet with a few silly transactions in it, similar to the TrueCrypt disk encryption system, where one password gives you real data and the other password gives you another set of data. Does this I'm going to edit that out, but that's the end of my thing. Go ahead and comments.
Well, the real question here is if there's really nothing showing that you have keys. I think that the big problem in cases like this is that they will assume that you have keys, and they will assume it with a sufficient probability to throw you in jail for contempt of court or whatever, the various key disclosure acts that you have around the world. So the real question is, how can you make sure that they cannot show a high probability that you have keys? Just having an Electrum client could actually give away that there are more keys than you're talking about. Or if they tap into your communication beforehand, they might see transactions that you actually did and then demand keys for the transactions and the addresses used in the transaction, which are keys themselves. Or they might see transactions through exchangers that then lead to further inquiry. So it's really not that smart to take this out of the context of a real criminal investigation. A real criminal investigation, they will collect all the data they can get on you. And I have to agree, we have to make sure that our keys are not known by us and provably not known by us. And how exactly that should be done is work in progress for various people. But a Brain wallet alone will not help you. It's more of a complete set of doing your crimes in a educated and professional manner, which means encryption and encrypted communication, anonymous communications, OTC transfers instead of using something like Antigox, and so on and so on.
Yeah, those are great points, talking about how they could see transactions that they link to you and then demand that you show... open up a wallet that actually points to those keys. And also you talked about them actually having some type of belief. Other panelists, wasn't there a case recently, I don't know if you guys saw it, I saw something in the news where a judge was making decisions about someone who supposedly had access to an overseas trust or had authority to open bank accounts and move money and the like, but there was no evidence about it. But he actually, you know, another case of one of these things where someone had spidey sense and they really truly believed that this guy did have some type of ability to whatever you call the ownership, or I don't know the legal term, when you actually have the ability to manipulate a foreign trust and its assets. And again, the judge had no proof of it, but it was held up in the U.S. that this guy was held as contempt or whatever, and he's being jailed based upon the judge's preponderance of belief that this guy did. And that same thing could happen with them actually believing, seeing an Electrum client or something like that, and then, well, you know, we believe that you actually have access to this information, whether they have proof of it or not.
There's two cases that are the big ones in the United States, and the facts are almost exactly the same. It was a full disk encrypted laptop, and in the one case, it was ruled that the person had to turn over the password to the encryption and allow the laptop to be encrypted. The other one, it was ruled that they didn't have to turn over the password, and the difference was in the details. The state said, this is like a safe. We could compel You know, if we had a safe and we knew that, that there was cash in that safe, we could take the door off the hinges, or we could compel the combination from the defendant. But in the one case, the defendant had actually admitted that there were files pertaining to the case on that laptop. And so in that case, the judge said, all right, you've admitted that, that's a good enough standard right there. You have to provide the password. In the other case, it was a complete phishing expedition, and they said, we think there's files pertaining to this case on this laptop, but the defendant had never mentioned anything about it. And so in that case, the judge ruled, nope, this is a phishing expedition. You have to know what's on there. And, of course, the state said, well, how can we know what's on there until we look in there? But the judge didn't accept that. So those are the two cases in the United States. So obviously, just like any time, never, ever, ever talk to the police. Don't tell them anything. There's nothing you can say to the police, to any law enforcement, that will help your case.
Well, except for saying, go away.
I don't even think that helps you. I think, you know, just hand them a card. Hand them your lawyer, your attorney's card. That's about it.
And the doormat that says, come back with a warrant.
Well, once again, they have a case of a lot of this comes down to proper tradecraft and using these technologies in with proper tradecraft. And some of these tools, like the Electrum client, and I think it's a multi-bit. There's a couple other deterministic type wallet systems out there. It's very fascinating when you look at these things and realize that you'd be able to instantaneously hand over keys to a wallet that they say is there that they want access to, and you go ahead and give them the keys, and when they open it up, there's just a bunch of silly stuff in there. It really, back to my original opening on this, it really reminds me of the system with the TrueCrypt when you have two different types of deniable partitions where you actually can give them access to the keys, but when they open it up, it gives them dummy information that is not what they're looking for. So any other comments on this before we close up here?
Well, just to the broader point, what you were just talking about, and in going back to our first topic of the crypto, the web crypto, or browser crypto, if you're going to deal with this stuff, if you're going to have money on your machine, well, actually, that's a separate point. But if you're going to be dealing with crypto, if you're going to be dealing with securing your systems, you have to go full paranoid. You have to go best practices all the way and always follow your best practices and not be half-assed about it, because half-assed will actually probably get you in more trouble and lead to more questions and answers that you have to give than if you go whole hog. But the other thing is never leave any more money in a wallet, in a hot wallet, than you're prepared to lose, than you would carry around in your pocket. The brain... We should be able to hide all these bitcoins in brain wallets, and it doesn't matter whether you have a Electrum client or even just the standard Bitcoin client, because you've only got 50 bitcoins in there or whatever, and they're going to have to subpoena until the cows come home to get pizza out of you for a brain wallet.
One final thing on that, I guess, is that this isn't limited to the U.S. Rick Falkvinge on falkvinge.net published an article this July pointing out that the UK has the same type of key disclosure laws, and they'll send citizens to jail for 5 years if they can't produce the key to an encrypted data set. And the kicker is that they don't have to be sure it's an encrypted data set, because encrypted data it looks like random bits. So you could have just a set of random numbers on your hard drive, and if the UK cops say, oh, we think it's encrypted data, please decrypt it, and you can't decrypt it, you can be put in jail for 5 years.
Yeah, so you could troll them by zeroing out your entire hard drive with random data before you cross the border, and then you'd get back at them. You'd have the laugh as you're sitting in jail for 5 years thinking, those idiots.
Yeah, I just had a very Orwellian thought. You know, if you use a brain wallet, you know, and they have the... I can just see them sitting there in some, dark room with a light over you, torturing you, saying, "We have the blockchain. Give us your brain wallet passphrase."
No, I won't be able to sleep tonight.
They could get those brain researchers from UC Berkeley we talked about that guess in the pen. They could make you fixate on your brain wallet phrase and flash up pictures of horses and pizzas and everything until they had your phrase.
They will never be able to break our sin.
Here's some drugs. Now just sleep, smuggler, while we listen to your dreams.
Oh, damn.
Yeah, I guess we're all screwed since they have possession of the blockchain. They have everything now, so it's just a matter of doing some mental extraction from us. Everybody, thank you very much for the great show today. We covered some good topics and everybody had good input all around. Thanks for listening, everyone. This has been Reality Exploit Roundtable Episode 9. And check out our other podcasts posted on agoristradio.com. And before we go, Smuggler, any projects you want to tell us about?
Well, October is nearing and Shadow Life will become online. That is Shadow Life CC, which will be a blog on privacy news and privacy technology. And sign up, it's free.
Super. Wise Guy.
Nothing here.
Voodoo, would you like to plug anything?
If you are looking for agorist businesses to do business with, you can go to blackandyellowpages.com, all one word, blackandyellowpages.com. And if you would like to list on Black and Yellow Pages, very simple, you can do business with anybody who lists on Black and Yellow Pages, and they can invite you to do your listings or send me an email at voodoo@blackandyellowpages.com, and we'll get you a listing.
Super. The Real Play-Doh, would you like to tell us about anything you're working on?
Oh, no, it's all totally top secret. None of you are actually clear to understand anything of what I do in my spare time. But if you want to just say hi, I'm on Freenode IRC and Enterplex IRC as Plato, and GitHub, Twitter, and Reddit as The Real Plato.
Super. And this is Hero. You check out other podcasts on agoristradio.com and .bit. Thanks, everyone, and see you next week.